Chapter 4. So, in the morning again, we started ahead of the porters and went down and across the hills and through the deeply forested valley, and then up and across a long rise of country with high grass that made the walking difficult, and on and up and across, resting sometimes in the shade of a tree, and then on and up and down and across, all in high grass, now that you had to break a trail in, and the sun was very hot. The five of us in single file, Droop and Imkola with a big gun apiece, hung with Musette and water bottles and the cameras, we all sweating in the sun, Pop and I with guns, and the Memsahib trying to walk like Droopy, her Stetson tilted down one side, happy to be on the trip, pleased about how comfortable her boots were. We came finally to a thicket of thorn trees over a ravine that ran down from the side of the ridge to the water, and we leaned the guns against the trees and went in under the close shade and lay on the ground. POM got the books out of one of the musettes, and she and Pop read while I followed the ravine down to the little stream that came out of the mountainside, and found a fresh lion track and many rhino tunnels in the tall grass that came higher than your head. It was very hot climbing back up the sandy ravine, and I was glad to lean my back against a tree trunk and read in Tolstoy's Sevastopol. It was a very young book, and had one fine description of fighting in it, where the French take the redoubt, and I thought about Tolstoy and about what a great advantage and experience of war was to a writer. It was one of the major subjects, and certainly one of the hardest to write truly of, and those writers who had not seen it were always very jealous and tried to make it seem unimportant or abnormal or a disease as a subject, while really it was just something quite irreplaceable that they had missed. Then Sevastopol made me think of the Boulevard Sevastopol in Paris, about riding a bicycle down it in the rain on the way home from Strasbourg, and the slipperiness of the rails of the tram cars and the feeling of riding on greasy, slippery asphalt and cobblestones and traffic in the rain, and how we had nearly lived on the Boulevard de Trompe that time. And I remember the look of that apartment, how it was arranged, and the wallpaper, and instead we had taken the upstairs of the Pavilion de Notre-Dame de Champs in the courtyard with the sawmill, and the sudden whine of the saw, the smell of sawdust and the chestnut tree over the roof with a madwoman downstairs, and the year worrying about money, all of the stories back in the mail that came in through the slit in the sawmill door, with notes of rejection that would never call them stories, but always anecdotes, sketches, contes, etc. They did not want them. We lived on Poirot and drank Cahors and water. And how fine the fountains were at the Place de l'Observatoire. Water sheen rippling on the bronze of horses' manes, bronze breasts and shoulders, green under thin flowing water. And when they put up the bust of Flaubert in the Luxembourg on the shortcut through the gardens on the way to the Rue Soufflot, one that we believed in, loved without criticism, heavy now in stone as an idol should be. He had not seen war, but he had seen a revolution, and the commune in a revolution is much the best if you do not become bigoted because everyone speaks the same language. Just as civil war is the best war for a writer, the most complete. Stendhal had seen a war, and Napoleon taught him to write. He was teaching everybody then, but no one else learned. Dostoevsky was made by being sent to Siberia. Writers are forged in injustice as a sword is forged. I wondered if it would make a writer of him, give him the necessary shock to cut the overflow of words and give him a sense of proportion, if they sent Tom Wolfe to Siberia or to the Dry Tortugas. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. He seemed sad, really, like Carnera. Tolstoy was a small man. Joyce was of medium height, and he wore his eyes out. And that last night, drunk with Joyce, and the thing he kept quoting from Edgar Quinet, fraîche rose comme un jour de la bataille. I didn't have it right, I knew. And when you saw him, he would take up a conversation interrupted 3 years before. It was nice to see a great writer in our time. What I had to do was work. I did not care particularly how it all came out. I did not take my own life seriously anymore. Anyone else's life, yes, but not mine. They all wanted something that I did not want, and I would get it without wanting it if I worked. To work was the only thing. It was the one thing that always made you feel good. And in the meantime, it was my own damned life, and I would lead it where and how I pleased. And where and how I led it pleased me very much. This was a better sky than Italy. The hell it was. The best sky was in Italy and Spain and northern Michigan in the fall. And in the fall in the Gulf off Cuba. You could beat this sky, but not the country. All I wanted to do now was get back to Africa. We'd not left it yet, but when I would wake in the night, I would lie listening homesick for it already. Now, looking out at the tunnel of trees over the ravine at the sky with white clouds moving across in the wind, I loved the country so that I was happy as you are after you've been with a woman that you really love. When empty, you feel it welling up again, and there it is. And you can never have it all, and yet what there is now you can have. And you want more and more to have and be and live in, to possess now again for always, for that long sudden ended always. Making time stand still, sometimes so very still that afterwards you wait to hear it move, and it is slow in starting. But you are not alone, because if you have ever really loved her happy and untragic, she loves you always. No matter whom she loves nor where she goes, she loves you more. So if you have loved some woman and some country, you are very fortunate, and if you die afterwards, it makes no difference. Now, being in Africa, I was hungry for more of it. The changes of the seasons, the rains with no need to travel, the discomforts that you paid to make it real, the names of the trees, of the small animals, and all the birds, to know the language and have time to be in it and to move slowly. I had loved country all my life. The country was always better than the people. I could only care about people a very few at a time. POM was sleeping. She was always lovely to look at asleep, sleeping quietly, close curled like an animal, with nothing of the being dead look that Carl had asleep. Pop slept quietly too. You could see his soul was close in his body. His body no longer housed him fittingly. It had gone on and changed, thickening here, losing its lines, bloating a little there. But inside he was young and lean and tall and hard as when he had galloped lion on the plain below Wami, and the pouches under his eyes were all outside, so that now I saw him asleep the way POM saw him always. Imkola was an old man asleep, without history and without mystery. Droopy did not sleep. He sat on his heels and watched for the safari. We saw them coming a long way off. At first, the boxes just showed above the high grass, then a line of heads, and then they were in a hollow, and there was only the point of a spear in the sun. Then they came up a rise of ground, and I could see the strung-out line coming towards us. They had gone a little too far to the left, and Droopy waved to signal them towards us. They made camp, Pop warning them to be quiet, and we sat under the dining tent and were comfortable in the chairs and talked. That night, we hunted and saw nothing. The next morning, we hunted and saw nothing, and the next evening, the same. It was very interesting, but there were no results. The wind blew hard from the east, and the ground was broken in the short ridges of hills coming down close from the forest, so you could not get above it without sending your scent on ahead of you, on the wind to warn everything. You could not see into the sun in the evening, nor on the heavy shadowed hillsides to the west, beyond which the sun was setting at the time the rhino would be coming out of the forest. So all the country to the westward was a loss in the evening, and in the country we could hunt, we found nothing. Meat came in from Carl's camp by some porters we sent back. They came in carrying quarters of Tommy, Grant, and Wildebeest, dusty, the meat seared dry by the sun, and the porters were happy, crouched around their fires, roasting the meat on sticks. Pop was puzzled why the rhino were all gone. Each day he had seen less, and we discussed whether it could be the full moon, that they had fed out at night and were back in the forest in the morning before it was light, or that they'd winded us, or heard the men, or simply shy and kept in the forest, or what was it? Me putting out the theories, Pop pricking them with his wit, sometimes considering them from politeness, sometimes with interest, like the one about the moon. We went to bed early, and in the night it rained a little. Not a real rain, but a shower from the mountains, and in the morning we were up before daylight and had climbed up to the top of the steep, grassy ridge that looked down into the camp, onto the ravine of the riverbed and across to the steep opposite bank of the stream, and from where we could see all the hilly slopes and the edge of the forest. It was not yet light when some geese flew overhead, and the light was still too gray to be able to see the edge of the forest clearly in the glasses. We had scouts out in three different hilltops, and we were waiting for it to be light enough for us to see them if they signaled. Then Pop said, "Look at that son of a bitch!" He shouted at Imkola to bring the rifles. Imkola went jumping down the hill and across the stream directly opposite us. A rhino was running with a quick trot along the top of the bank. As we watched, he speeded up and came fast trotting, angling down across the face of the bank. He was a muddy red, his horns shone clearly, and there was nothing ponderous in his quick, purposeful movement. I was very excited at seeing him. "He'll cross the stream,"
Pop said. He's shootable.
Imcola put the Springfield in my hand, and I opened it to make sure I had solids. The rhino was out of sight now, but I could see the shaking of the high grass.
How far would you call it?
All of 300.
I'll bust the son of a bitch.
I was watching, freezing myself deliberately inside, stopping the excitement as you close a valve, going into that impersonal state you shoot from. He showed, trotting into the shallow, boulder-filled stream, thinking of one thing, that the shot was perfectly possible, but that I must lead him enough, must get ahead. I got on him, then well ahead of him, and squeezed off. I heard the whonk of the bullet, and from his trot he seemed to explode forward. With a whooshing snort, he smashed ahead, splashing water and snorting. I shot again and raised a little column of water behind him and shot again as he went into the grass, behind him again.
Piga,
Imcola said. Piga!
Droopy agreed.
Did you hit him? Pop said.
Absolutely, I said. I think I've got him.
Droopy was running and I reloaded and ran off after him. Half the camp was strung out across the hills waving and yelling. The rhino had come in right below where they were and gone up the valley toward where the forest came close down into the head of the valley. Pop and POM came up, Pop with his big gun and Imcola carrying mine.
Droopy will get the tracks, Pop said. Imcola swears you hit him.
Piga,
Imcola said.
He snorted like a steam engine, POM said. Didn't he look wonderful going along there?
He was late getting home with the milk, Pop said. Are you sure you hit him? It was a god-awful long shot.
I know I hit him. I'm pretty sure I've killed him.
Don't tell anyone if you did, Pop said. They'll never believe you. Look, Droopy's got blood.
Below in the high grass, Droop was holding up a grass blade toward us. Then, stooped, he went on trailing fast by the blood spore.
Piga, Imcola said. Missouri.
We'll keep up above where we can see if he makes a break, Pop said. Look at Droopy.
Droop had removed his fez and held it in his hand.
That's all the precautions he needs, Pop said. We bring up a couple of heavy guns, and Droopy goes in after him with one article less of clothing.
Below us, Droopy and his partner who was trailing with him had stopped. Droopy held up his hand.
They hear him, Pop said. Come on.
We started toward them. Droopy came toward us and spoke to Pop.
He's in there, Pop whispered. They can hear the tick birds. One of the boys says he heard the faro, too. We'll go in against the wind. You go ahead with Droopy. Let the Mem Sahib stay behind. Take the big gun, all right?
The rhino was in high grass, somewhere in there behind some bushes. As we went forward, we heard a deep, moaning sort of groan. Droopy looked around at me and grinned. The noise came again, ending this time like a blood-choked sigh. Droopy was laughing.
Faro,
he whispered, and put his hand palm open on the side of his head in a gesture that means to go to sleep. Then, in a jerky-flighted, sharp-beaked little flock, we saw the tick birds rise and fly away. We knew where he was, and as we went slowly forward, parting the high grass, we saw him. He was on his side, dead.
Better shoot him once to make sure, Pop said.
Imcola handed me the Springfield he had been carrying. I noticed it was cocked. Looked at Imcola, furious with him, kneeled down and shot the rhino in the sticking place. He never moved. Droopy shook my hand, and so did Imcola.
He had that damn Springfield cocked, I said to Pop. The cocked gun behind my back made me black angry.
That meant nothing to Imcola. He was very happy, stroking the rhino's horn, measuring with his fingers spread, looking for the bullet hole. It's on the side he's laying on, I said.
You should have seen him when he was protecting Mama, Pop said. That's why he had a gun cocked.
Can he shoot?
No, Pop said, but he would.
Shoot me in the pants, I said, romantic bastard.
When the whole outfit came up, we rolled the rhino into a sort of kneeling position and cut away the grass to take some pictures. The bullet hole was fairly high in the back, a little behind the lungs.
That was a hell of a shot, Pop said. A hell of a shot. Don't ever tell anyone you made that one.
You'll have to give me a certificate.
That would make us both liars. A strange beast, aren't they?
There he was, long-hulked, heavy-sided, prehistoric-looking, the hide like vulcanized rubber and faintly transparent-looking, scarred with a badly healed horn wound that the birds had pecked at, his tail thick, round, and pointed, flat, many-legged ticks crawling on him, his ears fringed with hair, tiny pig eyes, moss growing on the base of his horn that grew out forward from his nose. Imkola looked at him and shook his head. I agreed with him. This was the hell of an animal.
How is his horn?
It isn't bad, Pop said. Nothing extra. That was a hell of a shot you made on him, though, brother.
Imkola's pleased with it, I said.
You're pretty pleased with it yourself, POM said.
I'm crazy about it, I said, but don't let me start on it. Don't worry about how I feel about it. I can wake up and think about that any night.
And you're a good tracker and a hell of a fine bird shot, too, Pop said. Tell us the rest of that.
Lay off of me. I only said that once when I was drunk.
Once, said POM. Doesn't he tell us that every night?
By God, I am a good bird shot.
Amazing, said Pop. I never would have thought it. What else is it you do?
Oh, go to hell. Mustn't ever let him realize what a shot that was, or he'll get unbearable, Pop said to POM. Imkola and I know, I said. Imkola came up.
Missouri, Wana, he said. Missouri, Sana.
He thinks you did it on purpose, Pop said. Don't you ever tell him different.
Piga, Missouri, Imkola said. Missouri.
I believe he feels just the way you do about it, Pop said. He's my pal. I believe he is, you know, Pop said. On our way back across the country to our main camp, I made a fancy shot at a reed buck at about 200 yards, offhand, breaking his neck at the base of the skull. Imkola was very pleased, and Droopy was delighted.
We've got to put a stop to him, Pop said to POM. Where did you shoot full, really?
In the neck, I lied. I'd held full on the center of the shoulder.
It was awful pretty, POM said.
The bullet had made a crack when it hit like a baseball bat swung against a fastball, and the buck had collapsed without a move.
I think he's a damn liar, Pop said. None of us great shots is appreciated. Wait till we're gone.
His idea of being appreciated is for us to carry him on our shoulders, Pop said. The rhino shot has ruined him.
All right, you watch from now on. Hell, I've shot well the whole time.
I seem to remember a grant of some sort, Pop was teasing. So did I remember him. I'd followed a fine one out of the country, missing shot after shot all morning, after a series of stalks in the heat, then crawled up to an anthill to shoot one that was not nearly as good. Taken a rest on the anthill, missed the buck at 50 yards, seen him stand, facing me, absolutely still, his nose up, and shot him in the chest. He went over backwards, and as I went up to him, he jumped up and went off, staggering. I sat down and waited for him to stop, and when he did, obviously anchored, I sat there using the sling and shot for his neck, slowly and carefully, missing him 8 times straight in a mounting, stubborn rage, not making a correction, but shooting exactly for the same place in the same way each time, the gun bearers all laughing. The truck that had come up with the outfit holding more amused niggers, POM, and Pop saying nothing. Me sitting there cold, crazy, stubborn, furious, determined to break his neck rather than walk up and perhaps start him off over the heat-hazy, baking, noontime plain. Nobody said anything. I reached up my hand to Imkola for more cartridges, shot again, carefully, and missed, and on the 10th shot broke his damn neck. I turned away without looking toward him.
Poor Papa, POM said.
It's the light and the wind, Pop said. We had not known each other very well then. They were all hitting the same place. I could see them throw the dust. I was a damn bloody stubborn fool, I said. Anyway, I could shoot now. So far, and aided by flukes, my luck was running now. We came on into sight of camp and shouted. No one came out. Finally, Carl came out of his tent. He went back in as soon as he saw us, then came out again. Hey, Carl, I yelled. He waved and went back in the tent again, then came toward us. He was shaking with excitement. I saw he had been washing blood off his hands.
What is it?
Rhino,
he said.
Did you get in trouble with him?
No, we killed him.
Fine, where is he?
Over there behind that tree.
We went over. There was a newly severed head of a rhino that was a rhino. It was twice the size of the one I had killed. The little eyes were shut and a fresh drop of blood stood in the corner of one like a tear. The head bulk enormous, and the horns swept up and back in a fine curve. The hide was an inch thick where it hung in a cape behind the head, and was as white where it was cut as freshly sliced coconut.
What is he? About 30 inches?
Hell no, said Pop. Not 30 inches.
But he is a very fine one, Mr. Jackson, Dan said.
Yes, he's a fine one, Pop said.
Where did you get him?
Just outside of camp.
He was standing in some bush. We heard him grunt.
We thought it was a buffalo, Carl said.
He is a very fine one, Dan repeated.
I'm damn glad you got him, I said.
There we were, the three of us wanting to congratulate, waiting to be good sports about this rhino whose smaller horn was longer than our big one, this huge, tear-eyed marvel of a rhino, this dead, head-severed dream rhino, and instead we all spoke like people who were about to become seasick on a boat, or people who had suffered some heavy financial loss. We were ashamed and could do nothing about it. I wanted to say something pleasant and hearty. Instead,
"How many times did you shoot him?" I asked.
"I don't know. We didn't count. 5 or 6, I guess."
"5, I think," said Dan.
Poor Carl, faced by these three sad-faced congratulators, was beginning to feel his pleasure in the rhino drained away from him.
"We got one, too," said P.O.M.
"That's fine," said Carl. "Is he bigger than this one?"
"Hell no, he's a lousy runt."
"I'm sorry," Carl said.
He meant it, simply and truly.
"What the hell have you got to be sorry about with a rhino like that? God damn it, he's a beauty. Let me get a camera and take some pictures of him."
I went after the camera. POM took me by the arm and walked close beside me.
"Papa, please try to act like a human being," she said. "Poor Carl, you're making him feel dreadfully."
"I know it," I said. "I'm trying not to act that way." There was Pop. He shook his head.
"I never felt more of a four-letter man," he said, "but it was like a kick in the stomach. I'm really delighted, of course."
"Me too," I said. "I'd rather have him beat me. You know that, truly. But why couldn't he just get a good one, 2 or 3 inches longer? Why did he have to get one that makes mine look ridiculous? It just makes ours silly."
"You can always remember that shot."
"The hell with that shot, that bloody fluke. God, what a beautiful rhino.
Come on, let's pull ourselves together and try and act like white people with him."
"We were awful," POM said. "I know it," I said. "And all the time I was trying to be jolly. You know I'm delighted he has it."
"You were certainly jolly, both of you," POM said.
"But did you see Imkola?"
Pop asked. Imkola had looked at the rhino dismally, shaking his head, and walked away.
"He's a wonderful rhino," POM said. "We must act decently and make Carl feel good."
But it was too late. We could not make Carl feel good, and for a long time we could not feel good ourselves. The porters came into camp with the loads, and we could see them all, and all of our outfit go over to where the rhino head lay in the shade. They were all very quiet. Only the Skinner was delighted to see such a rhino head in camp.
"Missouri Sana,"
he said to me, and measured the horn with the shiftings of his widespread hand.
"Kubwa Sana."
"Indio, Missouri Sana,"
I agreed.
"Wanna Kabor shoot him?"
"Yes."
"Missouri Sana?"
"Yes," I agreed. "Missouri Sana." The Skinner was the only gent in the outfit. He had tried, in all the shoot, never to be competitive. Carl and I had each tried to give the other the better chance on everything that came up. I was truly very fond of him, and he was entirely unselfish and altogether self-sacrificing. I knew I could outshoot him, and could always outwalk him, and steadily he got trophies that made mine dwarfs in comparison. He had done some of the worst shooting at game I had ever seen, and I had shot badly twice on the trip, at that Grant, and at a Bustard once on the plane. Still, he beat me in all the tangible things we had to show. For a while, we had joked about it, and I knew everything would even up, but it didn't even up. Now, on this rhino hunt, I had taken the first crack at the country. We had sent him after meat while he had gone into a new country. We had not treated him badly, but we had not treated him too well either. And still, he had beaten me. Not only beaten was all right. He had made my rhino look so small that I could never keep him in the same small town where we lived. He had wiped him out. I had the shot I had made on him to remember, and nothing could take that away, except that it was so bloody marvelous I knew I would wonder sooner or later if it was not really a fluke in spite of my unholy self-confidence. Old Carl had put it on us all right with that rhino. He was in his tent now, writing a letter. Under the dining tent fly, Pop and I talked over what we had better do. He got his rhino anyway, Pop said. That saves us time. Now you can't stand on that one.
No.
But this country's washed out. Something's wrong with it. Droopy claims to know a good country about 3 hours from here in the trucks, and another hour or so in with the porters. We can head for there this afternoon with a light outfit, send the trucks back, and Carl and Dan can move on down to Mutuumbu, and he can get his oryx.
Fine.
He has a chance to get a leopard on that rhino carcass this evening, too, or in the morning. Dan said they heard one. We'll try to get a rhino out of this country of Droopy's, and then you join up with them and go on for Kudu. We want to leave plenty of time for them.
Fine.
Even if you don't get an oryx, we'll pick one up somewhere.
Even if I don't get one at all, it's all right. We'll get one another time. I want a kudu, though.
You'll get one. You're sure to.
I'd rather get one, a good one, than all the rest. I don't give a damn about these rhino outside of the fun of hunting them. But I'd like to get one that wouldn't look silly beside that dream rhino of his.
Absolutely.
So, we told Carl, and he said, whatever you say, sure, I hope you get one twice as big. He really meant it. He was feeling better now, and so were we all.